Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show. We're back from the Christmas break, mopping up the movies that we missed and looking to the future. And luckily, 2014 starts with a bang, with a firework display of Oscar contenders. Coming up, we've got the film about slavery, the film about imprisonment, and the film about torture. Woohoo! Happy New Year. Coming up on this week's show, Idris Elba takes the long walk to freedom as Nelson Mandela. Colin Firth goes to war against the past as the Railway Man. And just to lighten the tone, a bunch of old crocs have themselves a rocking good time in Las Vegas. But let's kick off 2014 with 12 Years a Slave, a tale of human bondage in 1840s Louisiana, based on the memoir by Solomon Northup and surely destined for Oscar glory. Catherine Shaw sat down with the film's director, Steve McQueen, and its star, Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Solomon Northup is an expert player on the violin.
I was born a free man, lived with my family in New York.
Be good for your mother.
Until the day I was deceived.
To Solomon.
Kidnapped, sold into slavery.
Well, boy, how you feel now?
My name is Solomon Northup. I'm a free man.
And you have no right whatsoever to detain me.
You're no free man. You're nothing but a Georgia runaway.
It was a vile, disgusting, violent time in history. And I think people were very, very ashamed of it, and understandably so. But for me, now is a time to sort of, again, as an artist, once you sort of have a situation where you could work with material in a way that you could present it to the public in a way that you feel is urgent, because it hasn't been looked at in a real way before, as far as I'm concerned, it makes it much more sort of, how can I say, important in a way.
All I know, we were traveling. We wish we'd die trying.
Survival's not about certain death. It's about keeping your head down.
Days ago, I was with my family. In my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
It's 150 years since these events happened, which is an incredibly short amount of time historically, you know, and we live in the same era as the events that these things happened in, and with seismic differences, but also with numerous similarities. So we understand our societies as well through the history of our societies. So I think we can draw parallels and relevances from stories like this.
It just was one of those things where it was a story which was extraordinary, interesting, but not only interesting, extraordinary. You know, and also the fact that it was slavery, yeah, I suppose people could say that, because maybe that film hasn't been presented before in this way. I don't know if it's necessary. All I can say is that I'm happy I made it.
I'm joined now by the Guardian film critic Peter Bradshaw and films editor Catherine Shaw. Peter, there's been a huge head of steam building behind this film since it premiered on the festival circuit last autumn. Can you understand why that is, having seen it?
Yes, I can. It's had so much enthusiasm and so much love that I almost, through sheer contrarianism, wanted to kind of knock it down a little bit, but I just can't. It really is a very, very brilliant film. It's got all Steve McQueen's visual technique, his visual brilliance, his flair for shocking and confrontational imagery. But here, I think he takes it to the next level. He's gone up a notch to something where something was real feeling. Not that the others didn't have real feeling as well, but I got the sense with Hunger and Shame that there was a sense of what I can only describe as sort of video art technique, which was distancing. It was brilliant, but it was kind of refrigerated and distancing. Whereas this is really passionate and tragic. It has what I can only describe as a kind of tragic grandeur. And I was absolutely swept up by it. I thought it was really a very remarkable film.
Catherine, you were tipping it as an Oscar winner back in September. You rolling back on that now?
No. <Yeah. laughs> I think anyone that saw it back in September at its premiere would have tipped it. I mean, the whole auditorium was up in cheering arms. Yeah, it's funny. I saw it for a second time, and I was slightly less impressed in a funny kind of way. And then I saw it for a third time, and then it seemed even more impressive, if that's possible. It is actually a film that really does grow.
What's impressive about it?
Well, I think what Steve McQueen has done is he's actually gone a lot more mainstream than in those first two films. And what
almost conventional.
Well, that's right. And a lot of what I thought was a problem in the second time I saw it, which is kind of the fairly standard casting. So Paul Dano as a little bastard who used to be kicked out.
Cowardly racist.
That's right, exactly. And Brad Pitt as as the good guy. Mm. And Paul Giamatti as the sort of almost theatrical... semi-bad guy, things like that, that seemed a little bit coshing, and the music seemed a bit, the thing is with this, surely you know that this is a terrible wrong. You don't need to hammer it down people's throats. But then on the third viewing, I thought, in fact, that sort of relentless force with which he hammers it is sort of part and parcel of the theme and of the aesthetic and of what he's done. I think it's an absolutely extraordinary film.
About this time last year, we had Django Unchained, which was very much a kind of contemporary view of a historic period with all that entails and that kind of, cartoony revenge violence with Django as this angel of vengeance, I guess.
Yeah.
Judged alongside that, the Solomon Northup character here seems passive. He's a victim.
He does. He does not visit righteous justice and righteous revenge on the system in the way that Django does. Undoubtedly, he doesn't. But the fact that he doesn't makes it all the more real and more piercing of what he's gone through and what we've all gone through watching it, to be honest with you. As Django, it's sort of pulp mash-up stuff. Mm. And I thought Django was brilliant. And it broke the tactful hush about slavery in a way. It sort of prepared the ground in a way for this movie. That and arguably Lars von Trier's slavery satire, Mandalay, arguably prepared the ground for this film. But I think what's also interesting is that it's introduced you to the concept of the good slave owner and the bad slave owner. And first of all, you think, well, that's a rather glib distinction, isn't it? You have Benedict Cumberbatch, of course, playing the troubled liberal guy who seems to be nice. And of course, then you have Michael Fassbender, of course, as Epps, who is a sadist, a sexual abuser, and somebody whose self-hate is coming out in his abuse and violence. But what I think Steve McQueen is saying is, look, in a way, the good guy is even more culpable.
Yeah.
He just behaves in a kind of brow-furrowing, troubled way and reads scripture passages in these bizarre open-air al fresco church services to the house staff and the household at the same time. There is a sense in which he's even more insidious and culpable than the obvious nightmare of Epps.
And also, I mean, they make Epps a sympathetic character because they make his sexual abuse of Patsy not just sex, but there's an implication that he's actually in love with her and he's conflicted about that. That's not in the book. I mean, it would be bizarre if it were. But I found that slightly difficult, actually. There's that extraordinary scene near the end that lots of people have that has been the sort of fire for the torture porn thing where Patsy is very badly beaten. And it's an incredible scene, technically. Mm. It's one shot, one take, it's unbelievable. Mm. But that is laced through with the idea that Epps is actually emotionally involved and conflicted through love. And that's difficult as well.
I know what you mean. I didn't find that problematic because I didn't find it sympathetic to Epps. I think what he's saying is that it's quite natural that anybody, a good guy or a bad guy, could find themselves developing proprietorial emotional relationships to their property. And Patsy is one of these people. She is the object of his bizarre, misunderstood, regressive, infantile, and thoroughly dysfunctional feelings, which he doesn't understand them, and which are mutated so easily into self-hate and rage, and inevitably he takes it out on her.
I went to Master Shaw's plantation.
You admit it?
Yes, freely, and you know why. I got this from Mrs. Shaw. Mrs. Epps won't even grant me no soap to clean with. I stink so much I make myself gag. 500 pounds of cotton, day in, day out, more than any man here. And for that, I will be clean. That's all I ask.
Man's inhumanity to man in 12 Years a Slave. Next up, we have The Railway Man. It's based on a true story and stars Colin Firth. And here we go again. It's a film about man's inhumanity to man.
Sir, I'm afraid the museum is closed.
I've come a very long way. I have a particular interest in knowing what happened here.
The Railway Man, adapted from the memoir by Eric Lomax, stars Colin Firth as the traumatised former POW, melting down in his marriage to Nicole Kidman and looking back to his years on the Burma Railway when he was played by Jeremy Irvine. He wants answers, he wants peace. Just maybe he wants revenge as well.
I'm surprised you don't recognise me. Sit down, Mr. Negus.
Catherine, another film that you first saw at Toronto last year and quite liked it.
I did, and I still do, although it's one of those ones that doesn't necessarily, on second viewing or third viewing,
build.
It sort of exposes the problems that I think are inherent in the very narrative that you have here, which is a strange story that starts in the film as kind of later life romance and then moves through to sort of post-traumatic stress and then sort of travelogue revenge drama. It's, you know, which is sort of ambitious and bold and interesting that you have this strange thing. It's quite weird. I mean, I think it is moving, and I think the performances are great. I think narratively there's problems, like the idea that it's, you know, these two meet and court and fall in love and get married, and it's on their honeymoon, on their wedding night, she realises that actually he's seriously damaged kids. Things like that, they, you know, lend themselves in retrospect or in hindsight to sort of parody. But I think there's a lot to enjoy here. I think a lot of people will see this. I think a lot of people will find it very affecting. It's a brave and interesting film, and one shouldn't take the mickey out of it, actually, as I just have.
Okay, Peter, are you prepared to take the mickey out of it? It's a reliable performance from Firth, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not one to take the mickey out of it, but I do think there are quite serious and I think insuperable problems with it, and I think they are, in the main, casting problems. Basically, Nicole Kidman looks as if she's in training to play Grace Kelly or something, to play Lomax's wife. His second wife, actually. His first wife has been entirely airbrushed out of this story. Mm. And she just looks so grand and so queenly and so frozen. And Stellan Skarsgård playing his mate, he seemed to be making no attempt whatsoever to do a Scottish accent.
He's supposed to be British.
I think he's supposed to be Scottish. Yeah. But he just does his normal voice. The same voice he had for Nymphomaniac, basically. And so it wasn't at all easy to read his performance and see how anguished or angry he was supposed to be. So I think there were problems there. And also the problems in Lomax's early life when he's having a breakdown. And at one stage, he even goes for the bill collectors with a knife. And that scene sort of flashes past, but it seems to have no consequences. Yeah. I mean, is he visited by the police? What happens there? Yeah. But he just goes back to normal, and we go back to the sort of stiff upper lip Colin Firth kind of Route One mode. And so I was a bit baffled. But having said that, there are some sensationally good moments. And Jeremy Irvine is good, playing the young Lomax. It's good the way he pastiches a young Colin Firth.
And kind of looks right.
It does the mannerisms right. It's a very nice performance from him. But it doesn't mesh.
Yeah.
It clunks, and, you know, we're clunking over the points a bit, really, in The Railway Man. It just doesn't... There's something wrong, I think, in it, but there are some great moments in it.
Well, I'd never been to the Highlands before, so suddenly, finding myself single again, so to speak, I thought I'd like to see them. So, I'm going to go up as far as Mullaig by train, and then I'm catching the coach to Inverness and coming down the other side. What do you think?
The West Coast is extraordinarily beautiful. You might well fall in love with it.
And if I were to fall in love, what then?
Well, instead of a coach to Inverness, you might consider taking the line back to Tindrum and changing for Oban. And from there, you can get any number of boat trips. Iona, Staffa. It's very romantic. You romantic?
Colin Firth goes in search of closure in The Railway Man. And after all that, it's almost a relief to come staggering into Last Vegas, a bawdy Hollywood comedy about a bunch of old geezers living at large in Sin City. The party, belatedly, starts right about now.
Welcome to Las Vegas.
I want all of you to get in trouble.
Robert De Niro, Morgan Freeman, Kevin Kline and Michael Douglas cordially invite you to spend a wild weekend in Vegas. There will be gambling and swimwear competitions and the guzzling of liquor from the pert breasts of ice statues. Please be advised, there will be no refunds. And you need to bring your own Viagra.
Well, these red ball of Viagra's are strange. I feel like I'm getting drunk and electrocuted at the same time. I probably should get up and dance, but I'm used to having a partner. Well, it doesn't seem to matter to that fella. Maybe I'll give it a shot. Maybe not. Maybe now.
Catherine, we've got a whole roster of Oscar winners there, so what could possibly go wrong?
Nothing, and indeed it is a rival to Twilight. Actually, it's pretty bad, isn't it? And it's sort of, it's more than that, it's quite offensive for quite a lot of it. Particularly the wet T-shirt judging.
Oh, yeah.
The swimsuit.
Well, they give 10 to all the lovely ladies, but then someone that their own age comes out and they're like, ooh.
And maybe somebody a bit fat.
Yeah, someone a little bit fat and a bit old. Yeah. And they're like, ooh, dear. I wouldn't be seen dead with someone that age.
And the blowjob joke is particularly choice. It's very tasteless and it's a bit depressing. One had hoped this would be funny, right? And good.
Because the other thing that was interesting for me is that you've got all these old guys, like, you know, they've got hip replacements, one of them's had a stroke, they're kind of shuffling around. And they come into Las Vegas and like all these sort of 20-something girls by the pool react with this kind of salivating delight to see them. They just can't believe who's walked in. They're like, oh, like that. And you're thinking, they must all be sex workers. They're touting for trade. And yet there's no...
I get the horrible feeling this film is another part of the agitprop for Las Vegas. All these, I don't know, tourists who go to Las Vegas thinking it's going to be like that, or one of these millions of, like, Ocean's 11, that it's going to be this exciting, glamorous place, and it's going to be this horrible, ghastly dump, basically. I have a good impression that I think it was it Michael Caine said he wanted to do a film once because the script read, scene one, external day, south of France. He just thought, that sounds great.
Oh, yeah.
I'll do that. And I think they just thought,
absolutely.
Hey, it's set in Vegas. Yeah. All these guys I love, you know, God, it's Michael. Mike's going to do it.
Morgan's
going to do it.
They're going to put us in a nice hotel.
They're going to put us in a... It's going to be great. It's going to be fun. Sure, why not?
I didn't mind it, though. You know, having said all that.
Having said that.
I thought it was all right. I thought they're all... Well, they're the real pros in Las Vegas. They can fake emotion quite well. And Douglas, particularly, had a bit kind of, there's a sort of pathos to his character.
Well, you'd know.
Here we go way back. So it's objectionable, it's offensive, it's lazy as hell. And yet the four of them, they know what they're doing.
But, I mean, De Niro has a terrible eye for scripts at the moment. I mean, just, you know, he's in dreadful film after dreadful film, Big Wedding, this, The Family, God. Morgan Freeman will do any old crap. And, you know, but Michael Douglas, you know, my estimation of him had gone up a lot lately, but whoosh, straight back down.
The penthouse villa. Dollar for dollar, one of the best suites in all of Vegas. Four bedrooms up top, fully stocked bar, gourmet kitchen, and all the amenities you see before you.
You know what I feel like? I feel like a damn princess.
So intimate, that's what I love.
I'm at your disposal for anything else that you might need.
Is that your job? You're just here for us?
I can't believe who I was supposed to be hosting this weekend.
Who?
Fitty.
B-Fitty?
50.
50 people in there?
No, 50 Cent. Curtis Jackson.
Oh, for the Jackson 5,
yeah,
sure.
Okay.
Robert De Niro, Morgan Freeman, and the other ones in Last Vegas there. Just time for one more film, and we now return to this week's themes of imprisonment, injustice, and forgiveness, and of course, man's inhumanity too. But you get the idea. It's Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom.
I have a beautiful wife. I have beautiful children. I want them to walk free in their own land.
We will fight for our freedom!
Idris Elba is Nelson Mandela, lawyer turned activist turned prisoner turned president, an inspiration to billions and the radical hero of a conservative biopic. Justin Chadwick's dogged, respectful drama ushers us all the way through his turbulent life and times.
Does somebody want me?
I have cherished the ideal of a free society. It is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
Peter, an inspirational life, but an inspirational film?
Well, yes and no, or yes and sort of maybe. It's not bad. It's about as good as you could have hoped. So something that's so close to the subject. Mm. It's obviously conceived on very traditional, uplifting kind of epic lines. But unlike, say, T.E. Lawrence or Gandhi for David Lean and Richard Attenborough, Nelson Mandela happened, you know, his death was the day before yesterday. We're still coming to terms with it. We're still trying to absorb it. And so this very, very Route One film is probably the best we could have hoped for. It's not bad. It's not bad at all. Idris Elba did his best. He doesn't look much like Nelson Mandela, to be honest
with you. No, but he's got the kind of good body language and the pattern of speech as well.
Yes, he did. He does a good job, the walking, talking Mandela. And it's not just mimicry. It's very, I think, deeply felt. And Naomi Harris is very good as Winnie Mandela, of course, and it didn't pull any punches about Winnie. It shows Winnie's own role in the necklacing and the cracking down.
I wanted more of that, though. That was interesting.
Yeah, you wanted more. I got the impression that we were allowed to think that because Nelson himself had conceded that in his autobiography, because his autobiography came out after the divorce. And so the uneasy attitude to Winnie is his own uneasy attitude and our uneasy attitude to her, because she was the one who was keeping it real outside. I mean, she went to prison, and she was the one who never got any... She never got any tragic grandeur. She never got any saintly aura. That never happened for her. It happened to Nelson, but it didn't happen to her. Mm. And I think there is a more interesting story, in fact, to be told about her.
Yeah.
In a way, a biopic about her,
yeah.
I think, possibly would be... I don't know, it's perhaps being... too contrary to say, more interesting than Mandela. Of course it's not. I think, what can you say, the extraordinary, the almost Zen mystery of how did he change in 28 years in prison? He went into prison, he was expecting to be hanged, he wasn't. What happened? How did it happen? There's a sort of unlocatable mystery, I think, in real life. How can any movie do that? Can you go inside the solitary confinement cell with him
and say, see that journey?
This is how he changed.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know whether any movie could do it. Maybe other movies in 5, 10 years, 20 years' time can. I think this movie, Justin Chadwick and William Nicholson, they did a really good professional job in trying, and it's a watchable movie.
Catherine, this might give us the history, but did it give you any insight into Mandela himself?
No, I'm not, sure it really gave me the history either, because, I mean, I assume that I'm quite ignorant about Mandela, and I thought a film of this length would give me a lot of information, be very comprehensive. In fact, it felt quite cursory, and I realised that perhaps I do know most of the stuff about Mandela. Of course, I don't, and I'd have liked to know what was really going on. And it didn't give me a sense of, as you say, what happened in those years when he was in prison. It all just seemed, you know, a bit daft. I mean, there's that scene early on where you see him working out in the prison cell. And I just don't think Nelson Mandela had a body like that. He wasn't a Men's Health magazine, you know, from... I mean, you know, personal trainers will be, you know, cross, because what it suggests is all you need is a tiny prison cell and you can have this amazing body.
Digging some potatoes.
Yeah. But no, so apart, you know, it felt really, I was really disappointed in it. I thought it would at least be educational. I didn't find it that. I didn't find it moving. I just found it faintly absurd, I'm afraid.
You weren't even impressed by Idris Elba's performance in it?
You know, to some extent, for a guy that looks nothing like him, he does pretty well, you know? Yeah, but not so much. I mean, there's been a lot of Mandela movies, and in fact, there's been that Winnie biopic that nobody saw, the Jennifer Hudson one.
Oh, yes,
it was apparently so incredibly terrible that it never saw the light of day.
Oh, right, I hadn't seen that.
It's funny how there's been quite a lot of really quite bad movies about Mandela. I mean, that Goodbye Bafana was sort of...
That was awful. Thing. Yes, I remember with Dennis Haysbert and Joseph Fiennes. Yes,
yeah.
That was very tricky and also quite in slightly bad faith as well.
Yeah,
slightly bad faith.
What's interesting about this is that
maybe as little as a month ago, this was tipped as one of the kind of the big BAFTA Oscar contenders.
Mm.
And it's just not, is it? It's kind of, it's gone.
Well, it's got a nod for outstanding British film, which is weird, given that it hasn't got any others. You sort of think, oh, it all comes together to make an outstanding film, but none of the individual parts are apparently good enough, which is curious. I don't know. It's really interesting to see what its box office prospects will be. They've been massively changed by Mandela's death, I think. But yeah, I don't know. I don't see it doing awards business, really.
Idris Elba taking the man into history on Mandela, A Long Walk to Freedom. And that's it from us. My thanks as ever to Peter Bradshaw and Catherine Short. And thanks to you for starting the new year right here with us. Oh, the humanity. We're back next week.